Ray Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But hold your calls for a few minutes. We have with us on the line right now Jack Cashel, and Jack had put out a wonderful video called Silence. He and Jim Spencer had put that out a couple of years ago. Outstanding story of the downing of TW-800, and now he and Jim have written a book about what really happened that day, or of that evening, or at least their opinion of what really happened. Jim Saunders Jack Cashel and Jim Saunders had put out this new book. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight, Jack.
Hey, Stan, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Why don't you tell our listeners how you happened to write the book, what new information did come up, and, of course, how you put this whole incredible story together. It's obvious it's a major cover-up. There were over 100, close to 200 people who actually saw the missiles go up and explode adjacent to the plane. Massive explosion, no question at all. We haven't been told the truth. There's been a cover-up. But why don't you give us the background, give our listeners here in the Northwest and across America an understanding of what you feel happened that day.
Well, it is an extraordinary story. It's the great untold story of our time. And if the New York Times thinks it has a scandal on its hands now, I am hoping that when it's revealed how they blew this story, they will realize that Jason Blair represented their glory days. It's really a failure, Stan, of the media. I mean, governments fail. Governments tend towards corruption. Our Constitution was written around the fallibility of human nature. What they did not count on, and what continues to mystify me even now, is how the media continue to turn their back on so obvious a major story, perhaps the greatest story since Watergate in terms of political scandal. I got involved first, let me just perhaps set the scene for those who have not heard me talk before. The night in question is July 17th, 1996. The year and the date are both significant. The date because, for one thing, it was Iraq National Liberation Day, the high holy day on Saddam's calendar. It was also 2 days before the Atlanta Olympics, 3 weeks after the bombing of Khobar Towers in America killed 19 servicemen. The people who took responsibility for that destruction had faxed in a chilling warning the night before, predicting a spectacular attack against the United States. As a result, the military along the East Coast was on the highest state of alert since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, when the people on board 800 got on board, they did not realize this. There was 230 of them. They leave at 8:19 p.m., just about 10 minutes before sunset. They're heading towards Paris, out of New York, along the south coast of Long Island. Now, if your listeners don't know that coast, they should think of it as a affluent beach community teeming with people on a beautiful summer night, as you would imagine it would be. They're out on their decks, they're fishing boats, they're on the beach, and their helicopters, airplanes, all over the place. Now, as late as And here's why I talk about the New York Times scandal. As late as a year or two after the crash, the New York Times is still referring to the handful of eyewitnesses. Of those eyewitnesses, they would only interview one themselves, and the one did not see anything of consequence. In fact, however, there were, in terms of official FBI eyewitnesses, 750. Of those 750, 270 saw the following, and I'm going to paraphrase one guy's testimony, and everyone who's read the reports, myself included, I've read them all, will tell you that they're remarkably consistent. Here's roughly what he said. I was on the deck of my yacht club with my buddies, and I turned and I said, "Hey, look at the fireworks." And we watched this object come up off the surface, and then it was zigzagging out, and we thought, what is this? And then it's picking up speed, and it's going out further and further away from shore at a
45-degree angle. It's leaving a white, smoky contrail. It's got a red, burning tip. It's going further and further, faster and faster, and then it culminates in a massive explosion and followed by a fireball that descends rapidly to the sea. Multiply that by 270, and you have what these witnesses told the FBI. These witnesses were in planes, they were in helicopters, they were military people, they were architects and engineers, they were, you know, fishermen, and they told the same story over and over again. They were being backed up by the FAA radar technicians out of New York, who at the same second, on their screens, saw an unknown object merging with Flight 800, and then, much to their horror, Flight 800 disappears from the screens. It was the FAA, not the eyewitnesses, who set Washington abuzz. They raced their footage, their video, down to Atlantic City, their headquarters, from there to Washington, by 10 o'clock that night, 90 minutes after the crash. There was a full-blown meeting in the Situation Room of the respective security groups, and the president was holed up in the family quarters. We were in a state of war. It lasted about 5 hours, and then it went away.
Now, right now, of course, you had the opportunity to talk to Colonel Buzz Patterson, who was actually working there with the Clintons at that time. What did he tell you that the Clintons did at that time?
Well, you know what? I read his book, Deception of Dereliction of Duty, which is worth a good read, and it's a justifiable bestseller. Patterson carried the nuclear football for the president that summer and the next year. In other words, he was his highest conceivable security clearance. That night, he was as what got me interested in his book and why I called him is because in the summer of 96, he reports having come across the president's desk a series of plans by Islamic terrorists to use small planes filled with explosives and to attack American targets. As a pilot himself, this kind of alarmed him, the use of planes as flying bombs. So I called Patterson, and yes, he confirmed it was the summer of 96. I asked him when. He wasn't sure exactly, except he thought it was late summer, which would mean after July 17th. And then I asked him, you know, just holding my breath, where were you on the night of July 17th? And he said he was in the White House. And I said, well, you know, what'd you know? What'd you see, you know? He goes, I didn't know or see anything. They kept me out of the loop that night. He goes, usually he, you know, carries plans back and forth between the, you know, security conference and the president. And that night, he was not doing anything. He said he confirmed our what we reported, that the president was holed up in the residence. I asked him who was in there with the president. And he said the only person he thought that he could identify as being there, and we know is a very, very tight circle, was Sandy Berger, the deputy national security advisor. Well, this may struck us as a little curious because the national security advisor, Tony Lake, was kept out of that room. He was downstairs in his office that night awaiting the decision by that room. And so, Stan, it raises the question, why was the deputy there and not his boss on a night of such utter consequence? And the answer, we believe, is pretty simple. Tony Lake was a serious national security person with legitimate credentials. Sandy Berger was a lawyer, a hack, a political guy who was the political officer in the sense of national security. When political decisions were made, Tony Lake would often excuse himself. In other words, the decisions that were being made that night in the Oval Office were not military. They were not involved with national security. They were political, and that's totally fitting the spirit and time of that White House.
Well, you know, I think really what's so interesting, and I know you're well aware of the fact, is that the Islamic terrorists sent actually announcements to the various newspapers in Europe saying, we shot down TW-800.
Right.
But totally blacked out in America. Now, for the skeptic, there's a wonderful book called Bin Laden, The Man Who Declared War Against America, which we carry. And in that book, you'll actually read where Joseph Podansky, who is the chairman of the Congressional Task Force on the Terrorism and Unconventional Warfare, this is the Republican Task Force, you know, writes in his book that the Islamists bragged about this.
Yeah.
But, of course, they have such power over the American media that not a word of this was allowed. Anybody who wants to check the book, Podansky, the man who declared war against America. So how could they keep that out of the press in America? How were they able to actually conceal the fact that 270 Americans saw those missiles rise up and, of course, explode adjacent to the plane?
That's a great question. And by the way, if people who want to get an insight on what really happened that night, tell them to go to CNN on July 18th or the New York Times on July 19th, because for nearly 24 hours, it was pretty honest reporting. As you mentioned, Stan, the claims of responsibility were being denied, but at least they were being denied publicly, so we know there are claims made. How they were able to get away with this, I attribute really to the failure of the New York Times. The Times, this happened in their backyard. They were all over it. Now, what happens, that tends to intimidate the other papers. They figured, hey, you know, if the New York Times isn't reporting it, it's probably not true or true. I think that's changed a little in the last few weeks, as we know, but not then. And what made the Times more powerful in this little game was that the FBI chose to whisper exclusively in the ear of the New York Times. I was in Washington meeting with a Washington Post reporter a few weeks ago who covered this, and he confirmed that. He said, hey, we can only talk to the NTSB, and only then occasionally the FBI was talking to the Times. So for the first 5 weeks after the incident, the FBI clearly was steering the Times away from missiles, but they were allowing for the possibility of a bomb. In fact, they were strongly suggesting there was a bomb because mechanical failure, as they reported, and truthfully, was that it seemed remote and was becoming more remote every day.
In fact, the idea of an explosion in that central fuel tank was really not something they even really initially considered, is it?
Well, they ran it by. They ran up the flagpole, but they dismissed it because it simply didn't fit the evidence. You know, they concluded that the fuel tank caught fire 24 seconds after the initial blast. In other words, there was a fire finally in the fuel tank, but only when the plane was falling apart and, you know, the fuel was highly agitated. And, you know, they used the words like remote, extremely remote, unlikely, talking about mechanical failure. It seemed like in those first 5 weeks that bomb would be the acceptable scenario. And that would acknowledge the possibility of terrorism, but bombs aren't as frightening as missiles. And the scenario is more conventional, more orthodox. However, 5 weeks after the crash, that whole scenario changed. The FBI, now we're on the verge of the Democratic National Convention, and the Clinton administration got very uneasy with the notion of terrorism. How to explain this? On August 23rd, the New York Times led with this headline, and it on the upper right front, above the fold, on the upper left front, the headline read something like Clinton signs welfare reform bill. On the upper right was, conclusive evidence found that explosive device destroys Flight 800. This is 3 days before the convention. Then Clinton's message was literally getting blown away. So the FBI, head of that operation, was called to Washington. This is Jim Kallstrom. For the first 5 weeks, he had done, I think, a pretty sincere job. Not a particularly competent job, but a sincere one. And there was a coming to Jesus meeting. And I don't know what they told them, how they threatened them, or how they bribed them. I can tell you this, is that all behavior changed on the next day. The end of a search for a real culprit stopped, and what began was a search for a plausible scenario that might possibly hold the skeptics at bay and to create a likely, if not necessarily true, well, it wasn't true, they knew that, mechanical explanation why the plane went down.
All right, now, who was Jim Kallstrom?
Jim Kallstrom was the head of the New York office of the FBI.
All right.
And he was appointed in charge of the investigation. And he's a real take-charge kind of guy. He's a real serious guy with a good record. Louis Free was not involved in this at all. Janet Reno was non-existent. I mean, she was a figurehead anyhow. Jim Kallstrom really ran the show. And he was a real go-getter. A testament to which is in the first few days after the crash, he tried to interview the military. And he was told in no uncertain terms that, hey, this is none of your business.
And, of course, didn't the military deny that there were any military ships there?
For at least 6 months. They asserted that the closest military asset, other than one Navy plane, was 180 miles away, 185 miles away.
And they knew that they were lying because, of course, later they admitted that they were right there. There were a number of Navy ships right there. So they lied to the American people. And where is the outrage? I mean, where is the outrage from the New York Times that the Navy lied to the American people? Where is the outrage from the media as a whole? Where is the outrage from the American people?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because the New York Times was reporting these assertions that there was no assets, no ships within 185 miles, and then 6 months later, 9 months later, you see him saying that there's three ships and three submarines and a ship in the immediate vicinity of the crash. And there's no accounting, there's no reconciling these different stories. Now, the Navy, I would say this, and I think this with great confidence, it was not their idea to lie. I think they were compelled to. I think the reason given was national security, and it's a legitimate order coming and as a result of what we believe is a real national security emergency. Their missions were classified. They haven't talked to this day, and at least not publicly. No. We've had a few leaks, but always indirectly.
In other words, these are people in the military who really want to get the truth out, but they don't want to risk their reputation or maybe even their lives to do it.
Right, I think so. And in fact, many of our best eyewitnesses were military people, especially Navy people, like the Air National Guard pilots, a pilot, a passenger on board US 217, and others have been very cooperative. Those whose missions weren't classified, they're good citizens. They're our best citizens.
But I think it's important that our listeners understand that when you're in the military, and of course you're given a direct order not to reveal something, why, you better not reveal it.
Right, if it's classified, as their missions were, we know that, after the fact, you can't talk. I mean, you have prison.
Is that material still classified, what those ships were doing there that night?
Yeah, I mean, they've been remarkably tight about that.
No, right.
The FBI, in its press conference, 17 months after the crash, the FBI closed out its investigation at a press conference, and it admitted that, there were three submarines and a cruiser within the immediate vicinity, and under questioning, Kallstrom admitted that that was within 6 miles of the crash site. And yet, no one in the official media has ever bothered reconciling the first 6 months of stonewalling with their later admissions.
And of course, you actually, there are all sorts of radar evidence of this, that the ships were there.
Yeah.
And yet, of course, it wasn't until the radar evidence became apparent that they decided to change the official party line.
Right, because they had to, because it was, independent investigators, the best of which was Commander William Donaldson, himself a retired Navy wing commander, was saying, hey, what are these ships here? I mean, you said, the FBI has claimed to have turned over every stone and identified every, bit of evidence. It was 5 months into the investigation before they even acknowledged that these ships were there, and they never at least came clean identifying them specifically. The FBI did acknowledge that there were four ships in the area, but a fifth one, the one that was most likely the culprit, which was seen fleeing the scene at 35 knots, they never identified it to this day.
All right, and of course they could actually see this a ship moving away very, very quickly from the crash site. And of course the law of the sea is if there's an accident, everybody goes to the accident to try to rescue survivors, but there was one ship that didn't.
No, they did not. And this ship was big enough and fast enough that it was big enough to appear on radar and fast enough to be going at a healthy clip, like 35 knots. I know, and you're right, Stan, it should by all accounts, given its proximity, have gone right to the sea. It did not.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Jack Cashel. Jack, what's the name of your book, and how can people get it?
The book is First Strike, TWA Flight 800 and the Attack on America. It's available at all your major bookstores and Amazon and WorldNetDaily.com. Give you a discount.
All right, that's First Strike. Go to WorldNetDaily and order it from our friend Jill Farrer. Of course, you can get it through your local bookstore, but get it and read it and help Jack, who's he and Jim Sanders have worked their heart out to get the information for the American people. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Jack Cashel. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Jack Cashel, and of course we're talking about the downing of TW-800, and as we mentioned during the opening part of the program, over in Europe, of course, there were all sorts of articles in the newspapers, and of course the admission by the Islamic terrorists that they'd done this, but of course I think that the timing of the downing of the plane was so important. Certainly the elections were coming up. It was 1996, and would Bill Clinton, of course, be reelected? So this was July. The Democratic primary was to be held very shortly thereafter. Or had the Democratic Party primary hadn't been held
yet. We're talking the convention here,
right?
You know, which was the big coronation reelection convention. You know?
Okay, in fact, and then of course, just a few days later, while they have the bomb go off there at the at the Olympics, and of course, they can't admit that this might be the Islamic terrorists, so they arrest some poor local guy. In fact, he was the guy who actually announced and pointed out the suspicious bomb to the officials, wasn't he?
That's right. 10 days later, if you're looking for a parallel, there it was. Richard Jewell. Remember this guy, poor security guard? You know. Because, you see, this was peace and prosperity. Everything was wonderful in 1996 and that summer. There could be no terrorism. There could be no problems. And everything had to be okay. And so it was. And we did that by simply denying the obvious. And you cited Budansky before, and his book is excellent, by the way. I'm sure you've talked to him, read it. But he says very specifically, and it's the chillingly prophetic paragraph with which we start our book, and I'm paraphrasing again, but he says, by denying terrorists are due and floating mechanical theories, the government ensured that the next time a terrorist struck, they would do so in a way that no one could deny them responsibility. He wrote that in 1999.
And I think really what's so significant is the fact that they would arrest Jewell, who had actually told the authorities there in Atlanta that, there was a suspicious bomb. Why? Because by making him the issue and then, of course, eventually let him go after ruining his career and his reputation, they then would tend to diffuse the possibility that this was really another of the terrorist attacks. They knew that Osama bin Laden had been behind the downing of our helicopters in Somalia and the death of the Americans in 1994. They knew Osama bin Laden was behind the bombing at Riyadh in 1995, and he was behind the bombing there at the Khobar Towers just a few weeks beforehand in 1996. But, of course, they didn't want the American people to know that.
No, and that the Richard Jewell story deserves more attention, especially in light of what happened with Flight 800. The connection's almost never made. But Jewell pointed out this knapsack. You know, he's a security guard. He pointed out this knapsack to the Saudis an hour and 15 minutes before it went off. Terrorists don't do that, you know. They isolated the area. In fact, no one would have been hurt or killed. There was two killed, 112 injured. Had they done a better job of clearing the area, they just didn't want to panic people. And until it went off, they really weren't certain what was in it. He should have been a hero. From the first moment, they knew this man was being framed. This is a frame-up, and it wasn't accidental. This was conscious.
But, of course, this then tended to detract attention away from the Islamic terrorist involvement,
right,
which they knew was there, but they just didn't want the American people, at least at that time in history, to know about the Islamic terrorist involvement. With all the other attacks and the murder of Americans, we're going to be back here in just a moment when our other station returns to us. Well, Dr. Stan, I guess this evening, Jack Cashel, of course, his book, First Strike, that's First Strike, and you certainly want to get it. It's an amazing story. And a caller calls in and wants to know if there's any particular reason why TWA-800 was targeted. So I'm going to let you pick up the rest of the story, because now here's where the story gets very interesting. And there were other planes in the area, and there were responsible people on those planes that you've talked to and interviewed. So why don't you tell the story?
Okay, what I've told you so far is essentially 100% provable. I mean, it's all in the public record. It's scarcely even worth debating. Now we're moving into the era of, like, circumstantial evidence and eyewitness reports, and my confidence level about what I'm going to tell you drops to about 90%, at least in terms of our final conclusion.
It drops to 90%.
Doesn't drop 90%. Drops to 90%.
Right.
Here's what we know, is that There was another plane in the mix that night. A small plane.
Weren't there two planes in the mix?
Well, yeah, actually, there's several planes. Let's set the scene here, and I'm going to ask your listeners to try to draw a mental picture. Or actually, it'd be helpful if they had a winky-dink screen to put across their TVs. There was a TWA Flight 800 traveling east at 13,000-plus feet. At 21,000 feet heading north is U.S. Air 217. 217 is about ready to cross over 800's path, 8,000 feet above it. When, much to their horror, the passengers on the right side of 217 see what in the description of the best of the eyewitnesses, a 25-year Navy vet who knows a whole lot about airplanes, describes as a small private plane, a six-seater, coming directly at U.S. Air 217. He holds his breath and misses by 300 feet at 21,000 feet.
Well, this has got to be a jet or something, doesn't it? That high, or is this just a propeller-driven plane?
There's been a lot of debate about that. I'm not an aviation professional, but I've run it by people who believe that there are certain turboprops that could do that as a jet, small private jet, like a business jet. 15 seconds after that plane passes underneath 217, the witnesses see what everyone else saw. They see what looks like a flare come up off the surface, arc over, zigzag, blah, 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 culminating in a massive explosion. Now, the passenger behind the Navy vet sees this plane, and we believe it's the exact same plane, now circling back around. He follows it for 45 seconds, makes a big loop, heading back towards the west now, in the direction Flight 800 is coming from, at that altitude. And then he says, it's as if this plane that he's following, the smaller plane, runs into a wall, and its whole front end bursts into flames. Now I'm going to throw the view to these two National Guard helicopter pilots landing about 8 miles to the north at Grabowski Field, looking south, right at the scenario. The one pilot on the left, the captain, Chris Bauer, who's kept really mum about this, partly because he saw what happened to his co-pilot when he started talking, describes it as thus. He says, I see this flaming object coming from the east, which we believe to be the small terrorist plane. And then it runs head-on into another object coming from the west, and there's a massive mid-air. So he describes it as a massive mid-air collision. And then it results in a huge, bright white blast, a blast that his partner, Major Fritz Myers, who's flown over 100 missions over North Vietnam, describes as a military ordnance. He goes, I have no doubt this was military ordnance. It wasn't fuel tank. Fuel tank soft, yellow, low-order explosion. This was a high-energy blast. And neither of those two colliding objects, we know, was Flight 800. Damage to Flight 800, its nose wasn't essentially damaged. There was no head-on collision.
Oh, no, but basically, this plane, this small plane that was up at 21,000 feet, actually dove down to get adjacent to TWA-800. Was that what happened?
That's what we believe happened, based on the eyewitness evidence. And what we believe happened then is a U.S. Navy missile caught up with this plane and blew it out of the sky. Based on the NTSB's own reckoning, the massiveness of this blast had to have at least 1,000 pounds of TNT.
Now, that was on the plane. That wasn't the missile that was hitting
it. That's right. It was on the plane. Neither the missile nor a fuel tank was remotely capable of making that kind of blast or that kind of sound. It was a blast powerful enough to shake steel bridges 10 miles away.
And so basically what you're saying is that this plane was flying there, everything is on maximum alert, they're anticipating a terrorist attack. They see this plane is flying, doesn't have any transponder on, it's being actually tracked by one of our own spy planes.
By the Navy P-3, which is right behind it.
Right.
And we believe that 15 seconds after it went under 217, the Navy said, and the Navy saw what this plane, where it was heading now. It was heading right at Flight 800. They said, we have no choice. We have to fire. And they made that split-second decision. Once they made that decision, although they probably had gotten clearance before that from the president, which means that he may have been in the loop from the very beginning. Once they made that decision, they did what they had to do. And the consequences of it, although terrible.
We'll be right back in just a moment.
Might have been worse.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course the question is, why did it pick TW-800? Probably because it was just in the area. It wasn't necessarily picked, as far as we can tell. It wasn't necessarily the target, but Jack Cashel, of course, is conjecturing based upon the eyewitness reports from many, many people. Do you think that the plane was making an evasive action? Do you think they were aware of the missile? Or why would they have suddenly actually dived, as rapidly as they did?
And here I'm just speculating, Stan, based on the evidence.
Stadium, who knows where it was going? World Trade Center. That's speculating. I think it's after it's it took a run in 2017 and either missed or decided that it wasn't worth it. It was too small a plane, too small a target. Saw a flight 800 below. Went for that because I think it realized that the jig was up in any case. Probably knew the P-3 was on its tail. And then said, okay, if I'm going out, I'm going to take something with me. And that's what I imagine happened. Again, we'll never know, really, the motives of that pilot, because it was a suicide mission.
Now, okay, so there have been a lot of people who said, well, there must be somebody on that plane, that TW-800 they wanted to take out. And you think it was just it was a convenient target,
yeah.
And of course, when it got hit by the missiles and the explosion adjacent to TW-800, and that's what actually, of course, took out TW-800. Now, could you get into the aspect of this? First of all, we've been told that there is evidence of rocket fuel or something of the sort on some of the seats there in TW-800.
Right.
How do you explain that if there was a missile that took out the terrorist plane?
Well, I'm going to add the complicating factor here for everyone, and that is that there are at least two missiles fired. And by all accounts, the first missile, this is a Navy missile now, hits Flight 800 itself by accident. However, based on that, and this is the pattern you're referring to, it's a narrow blast range through the center of the cabin, just on three rows, and the first pieces of debris that came off were, along the right wing right there, explosive traces all over that side of the plane. It's quite likely that that blast was not catastrophic, at least not immediately. Given the size of the damage, the scope of the damage, it's altogether possible, likely, almost inevitable, that the pilot would have been able at least to make a mayday, to call for help, to say what happened, maybe even to limp back to base. I mean, that's not impossible. However, 2 seconds later, all thoughts of talking, speaking, whatever, communicating or going anywhere ended when this other blast occurred. By all accounts, a much, much larger blast. Also a high-energy blast, a high-explosive blast underneath the plane, by all accounts, that we believe just blew that plane right out of the sky, Flight 800, as well as the terrorist airplane. And it's a complicated scenario. It's not something that a president who's hell-bent on, preserving this image of peace and prosperity and everything's wonderful and that he's a commander-in-chief worth trusting, wants to present to the American public. I think if it happened in 1997, though, we would have known the next day. I think if anyone else had been president, we would have known the next day. I think it was a purely political decision.
All right, and of course the president has the authority, not the moral authority, but the legal authority to make such a decision. And then, of course, they put out all these counter stories. They thought that somebody was on that plane they wanted to bring down, or this plane was, wasn't supposed to be, the plane that was going up was supposed to be an Israeli plane, and this TW-800 got in front of it. All of this ancillary information, do you think that was just designed to confuse us, or was this simply the way things are reported and we end up confused?
I think it was a little of each, Stan, but your point is well made. And getting into this, we don't know how much of the information we get is disinformation, misinformation, or real information. So that's why, when doing the book, we spend so much time verifying the leads we get out from out of the military after September 11th on the scenario I just presented. And all the evidence supports it, so I don't feel uncomfortable saying it. But I sometimes think that in the early days after the crash, that people, including my partner, James Sanders, and he admits as much himself, and Pierre Salinger more notably, were encouraged, almost, to come to the conclusion that this was a practice the Navy was just sort of taking target practice off the coast, and they blew the plane out of the sky. And because, to me, I remember reading Sanders' book and being not appalled, but thinking to myself, what, the Navy's taking target practice off the coast of Long Island on a summer night? I just didn't buy it.
I know, because remember poor old Pierre Salinger.
Right.
I mean, he was a former United States Senator,
yeah.
Close advisor to President Kennedy. He comes up, makes a public statement, that the Navy shot down TB-800, and he is crucified and vilified and demonized and marginalized, and I haven't heard anything from him since then.
No, it ruined his career. I mean, it cost him $500,000 a year in consulting and speaking fees. And he's a good Democrat. He waited until November 7th, 3 days after the election, to make his pronouncement. He was in France at the time. His information wasn't bad. It was better than he was given credit for. He just didn't have the whole picture. And so with only half the picture, it makes it seem extreme and almost unbelievable. You know, in fact, when I heard it, I didn't believe it. You know, just to be honest with you. In fact, when we made our documentary in the spring of 2001, James Sanders and I, we left the ending inconclusive, as you know. We don't say who's pulling the trigger, because I wasn't confident in either scenario. Either the terrorist missile scenario never struck me as likely, I mean, for a variety of reasons, and nor did the Navy misfire. I said something, I always had the sense that we're missing some key detail. And that was applied to us after September 11th by two separate sources within the military, distinct sources, telling us the same thing. And they said, look to the skies. There's another plane involved. And we looked, and we found it.
Now, of course, this was in some of the reports, wasn't it?
It's in the... We just overlooked it. Everyone overlooked it. No one was looking at it. It's like, you know, sometimes you're... It's like a classic whodunit, you know? The answer is staring in the face, and you're just not seeing it. You're not looking. Several eyewitnesses talked about it. You know, we identified, finally... 7 eyewitnesses, and these are excellent eyewitnesses. All of whom, however, and this is a key factor, are not on land. Because if they're watching from the shore, they wouldn't have been able to see this scenario because of the lights of the evening. They were either at sea or on board other planes or in the helicopter. And when you put it all together, it makes a very, very convincing scenario, especially when you add the factor of the size of the blast, which is in a very intriguing conversation. These rank and file guys at the NTSB asked the CIA, they said, what caused this blast? What shook a bridge 10 miles away? They said, you know, a fuel tank explosion couldn't shake a steel bridge a mile away. And the CIA guys come back and say, yeah, well, real smart aleck, you can hear it in their voices. Neither could a missile warhead. And then the CIA guys, the NTSB guys come back and say, well, we've been doing our research, and what we found is you need at least 1,000 pounds of TNT at that distance to make that kind of resonance. And that, at which point, the NTSB brass step in and changed the topic. They were sitting right on the answer.
Well, you know, I think it's so interesting that how did the CIA get involved in this at all? And then, of course, they put out this foolish cartoon. They make this up that showed on every television station in the country just about, which shows how powerful the CIA is.
Yeah.
And of course, it shows the nose of the plane falling off after the central fuel tank explosion.
Right.
And then the plane climbing 3,000 feet. What was that cartoon all about? And of course, why was the CIA trying to convince the American people that there was there were no missiles fired?
And the way the investigation worked is to subtract from the database, from the data pool, all the variables that could be subtracted. And those that the government controls are relatively easy to do. So the FAA radar, you know, there's only a handful of people have seen that. So they can just say, hey, it was a computer glitch, an anomaly, which is what they said. Or the satellite imagery, they can classify that. The residue trail, explosive traces, they can classify, control all that. The one thing, the one variable they could not control were the eyewitnesses. And these are people along the coast of Long Island. These are affluent, you know, people with access to the media. And they were outspoken, and they still are, and they're angry because feel like they've been betrayed. And so what they did is they brought the CIA in because the CIA's job is deception. That's what they do for a living. Actually, they did a good job of it here. Their mission was to create some sort of scenario that could explain away what the eyewitnesses saw, at least plausibly enough, to buy some time. They only showed this once on TV. In fact, they pulled it immediately afterwards because it's so ludicrous. They won't even show it in the NTSB hearing. And the NTSB quietly disowned it. And it was ludicrous on the face of it. But what's worse then is that, and again, in this great conversation between the NTSB and the CIA, when they're questioning them as to how they came to make this, the NTSB rank and file guys asked the CIA exactly how many people saw that plane ascend the way you described. And after lots of hemming and hawing, the CIA analyst responsible admits there was only one, the man on the bridge. Now, through just a fluke in reporting, we were able to track down the man on the bridge. And we asked him. You know, when you first were interviewed by the FBI, you said that you saw the object come up off the beach and zigzag out away from shore. And then when the FBI went back to re-interview you at the CIA's request, that's when you said, no, you saw it for the first time 20 degrees above the horizon, right where Flight 800 was. And the CIA said that that's when they became more comfortable with their theory, when they saw the results of your second interview. And you know what the guy told us then?
What?
There was no second interview. The FBI never came back. And then we went into the files when they were finally released, and sure enough, there is no second interview.
So they were lying.
They made up. You have to understand, this is the single most critical bit of information in the whole investigation. The CIA spent 11 months concocting it. They showed it to the national audience. It was repeated with great enthusiasm by the major media, including New York Times and Newsweek, most notably, and bought. And they fabricated the sole interview on which the whole thing was based. Now, we can prove this 20 times over. And you would think that every major media outlet in the country would be clamoring for this story. And they're not. They're afraid of it, partly because it embarrasses them. When I visited Newsweek, I happened to raise the guy who wrote the story originally, that, aren't you the guys that did that full two-page, full-color pictorial spread on the CIA's animation? And he said, yeah. And I said, you really screwed that one up. You blew that one. And he was, I don't want to talk to you. I mean, this is at the end of the day when I knew they weren't going to talk to me anyhow, but I was being polite for the first three quarters of it. They blew it. The CIA and the New York Times congratulate. They write an editorial congratulating the FBI and the CIA and what a great job they did putting this conspiracy theory to bed.
Well, of course, anybody who's really investigated, we've, of course, talked to Christina Borgensen, who had actually been a producer for CBS 60 Minutes, trying to get the story out, and, of course, she got fired for it, and then, of course, she went to work for ABC, and somebody put pressure on them to kill the story, and now she's become a non-person, even though she's gotten Emmys in the past for her ability. She can't get a job any place in the media, because if you try to tell the truth, they will destroy you. In fact, we carry her book, Into the Buzzsaw, which, in fact, she talks about Jack Cashel.
Yeah, she mentions it, one of my incidents.
Why don't you tell our listeners about that? Because you were, of course, invited to be on CNN about your movie, because that was important. The American people, if 10 million Americans could have seen your movie, the silence, first of all, why you'd be well-to-do, but even more than that, why, of course, you would really, the American people would know that everything had been told.
Right, no one can watch that documentary without saying, we need to reopen this investigation. What happened is that I was scheduled to be on The Point with Greta Von Susteren when she was still on CNN. Her producer had called me the night before. This was the summer of July, the fifth anniversary, two summers ago. And she said, would you be willing to be on the show tomorrow? I said, yeah, sure. She goes, we may ask someone to go on with you. Is that okay? I said, yeah, sure, either way. You know, either with or without, I'd be happy to do it. Well, the next morning she calls me back and says, hey, guess what? We've gotten Jim Hall, who was then chairman of the NTSB, to go on with you. And I said, oh, great. And then I started thinking about it. And I said, dang. I said, what a responsibility I have here. This guy is a human pinata, and I'm playing without my blindfold on. I said, in one or two questions, I can knock this whole thing out of the sky. I could blow this whole thing open. I'll ask him, hey, tell me about the man on the bridge. Why did you make this up? Hey, Jim, why don't you apologize now to the American people for what you did? That's all I was going to say. And then it dawned on me, he'll never let me say this. I'll never get on this show. Who am I kidding? And so I sat around waiting for the phone to ring. And 2 hours before showtime, sure enough, it rang. Jack, Jim Hall won't be on the show with you. Okay, good. I'll go by myself. No, sorry. In the interest of responsible journalism, the people upstairs decided you can't come on. I said, I can't? No, but they decided in the interest of responsible journalism that Jim Hall can go on. Now, Jim Hall was the political crony out of Tennessee, a hack whose best qualification for the job, even according to the Washington Post, was his driver's license. And here he was, in the interest of responsible journalism, allowed to tell the story where I wasn't. And Greta Van Susteren threw him a couple of softballs. He could foul those off. He didn't even hit those, you know. She said, can you tell us with 100% assurance that the missiles weren't fired that night? Well, Greta, it's really about the families and preserving their privacy. Blah, blah, blah. It was just appalling, you know, but that's the way it works. And it's, you know, I was had few illusions about the media before I got involved with Flight 800. I have far fewer now. I have none. It's almost funny.
What about they even invited you on again, didn't they?
They invited me on again, and then they bumped me again, you know?
And I think that American people have to understand that you're not going to get the truth from most of the major media. Occasionally, well, but then, of course, it's so rare that you don't even realize that they are telling the truth when they aren't.
Yeah, it's like, it was like President Clinton. I'm sure he told the truth occasionally. He just didn't know when.
Right.
And he had so little experience with it, you know. It's just, when it comes up, actually the media do it. The TV do a good job with, like, tornadoes, and, crime and stuff. But when it comes to telling complex stories, especially those that involve political sensitivities, you seriously just can't expect them.
Well, you know, one of the bigger questions is, why did Boeing go along with this? They had to know that this wasn't an explosion of the central fuel tank. In fact, there was a plane that was blown up over in Thailand shortly after that, and the Thai said, gee, this is a bomb on board, and then, of course, the FBI immediately rushes over and said, no, it wasn't a bomb. This plane sitting there on the tarmac, suddenly the central fuel tank explodes. Tell me that story.
Yeah, that's an incredible story, because they needed this Flight 800 was sitting out there all by itself. There was no parallel. So, and I believe this was in early 2001, a bomb goes off on the runway in Thailand and, blows up the plane. Well, what made this suspicious were a couple things. One is that the embattled Prime Minister of Thailand was about ready to board the plane. He was like, can I get on 30 minutes later? And, he had just ratted out, like, 20 of his deputies in his huge corruption scandal, right? He was a marked man. And immediately the reporting was, bomb goes off, captain says, yeah, I heard this loud bang. Yes, they reported explosive traces all over the plane, you know. Everyone said it was bomb, yeah. They even had, the pattern of the interior destruction. Said bomb, 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 bomb. For 2 days, bomb, 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 bomb. And then the FBI and the NTSB are sent to Thailand to investigate this?
Now, why would the FBI go to Thailand to investigate a bombing on a Thai plane?
Right, on a Thai plane involving Thai citizens.
Right.
You know? It had nothing to do with us. Well, and sure enough, 30 days later, it didn't take them 4 years, it only took them 4 weeks this time, and they imposed the entire 800 paradigm on this plane.
And then, of course, they could justify and say, well, that's now two of them now that's happened. It never happened before, but now suddenly twice it's happened.
Yeah, it's a regular occurrence now, you know? And the same thing, the explosive traces go away, the center fuel tank is overheated because of sitting on the tarmac. Oh, it's 95 degrees in Thailand that day. And you know, the temperature wasn't the night of July 17th. It was 71 degrees. People reported the evening as being cool. Now, if a plane can overheat by sitting on a runway at 71 degrees, what about all these planes that are taking off from Libya and Saudi Arabia, you know?
Why did Boeing go along with this, because they had to pay out a lot of money, and obviously they know that it's not true.
They weren't happy about it, obviously, but they had one major kink in their own plans, and that is for the 2.5 years leading up to this crash, they've been working with McDonnell Douglas on a plan to merge. This merger would give them 100% control of the commercial airline production market. Now, the same Justice Department that would soon enough turned down a proposed merger between Office Depot and Staples, right? which would have given the merged entity a combined 6% of the utterly critical office supply market, gave Boeing and McDonnell Douglas approval of 100% merger of the seriously critical aviation, commercial aviation market. They had no choice. Plus, Boeing and executives are going with Ron Brown on his trade missions to China and elsewhere. I mean, they're not selling them planes overseas without the approval of the U.S. government. And that's where the markets were.
Well, anyway, of course, and Boeing agreed to it and let the whole thing go by the wayside and paid off because it was cheaper to do that than to try to fight Big Brother.
What's more, I talked to one ex-CWA pilot who's writing a book about this, is the CWA situation, the money situation. Why did CWA go along with it? Well, the pilots are appalled. They're horrified by what happened. But they believe that their CEO sold them out. In fact, in October, I just talked to one CWA employee last month or so. In October, she was working in St. Louis, and she was compelled to go to a fundraiser that the CEO, Jeff Erickson, had staged for President Clinton. This is 3 months after the crash. This doesn't make any sense. Something's going on here. And, to this day, the CWA employees are outraged. I mean, almost to a person. I haven't talked to a single ex-CWA employee who believes that this is mechanical failure.
Somebody just called in and said something about a KC-135 exploded coming into O'Hare in 1981. You know anything about that?
No, but I know it wasn't a center fuel.
All right, fine. Well, I certainly, everything I've been able to get suggested that's absolutely the case. But, of course, they can't let the American people know the truth.
Right.
Because, of course, once you've lied to the American people and they've gotten away with it, why, of course, you'd never believe anything they say again.
Sure. One of the variables to consider, too, Stan, is that as far as anyone at the NTSB could recall, there had never been a crash of an airplane, mechanical failure, in which the pilot did not get off some words to air traffic control.
Right.
Hey, you know what the final last word is that's heard most on these tapes? The last word?
What were the last words?
In terms of airplane crashes, when they realize they're going down.
Right.
I actually can't repeat it, but it begins with the letters SH.
Okay, well,
you would hope that the people would say something a little more, divinely inspired.
Right.
There's something about human nature when things are going in that direction for you to say that that's exactly where they're going.
Right. Well, anyway, of course, it's a terrible tragedy. Now, as you try to tell people this story of trying to get this thing out, across America, what sort of response are you getting?
I get a great response from people who listen. I mean, a really great response. I mean, people, I'm constantly get asked back to speak at, in stations and whatnot, and people can't believe it. It's like they're hearing a story for the first time. Then I go to New York and Washington and try to talk to the major media, and they're all, what's the opposite of all ears? All stones. I don't know. I mean, it's like banging my head against the wall. I tell them the same things I'm telling you and your audience. I tell them with the same level of confidence. I qualify what I don't know. I distinguish between what we know and what we believe to be true. And I tell them, I said, listen, there's only two choices. Either I'm handing you the greatest untold story of our time, your first Pulitzer Prize, or you can write the story about how a couple of charlatans exploiting the misery of victims' families, libeling on us as government officials, have created this whole concoction. Expose this. Here's all our evidence. We're going to put it on the table. Bring the other guys in. Let them put their evidence on the table. You write the story. You would think that any reporter worth his salt would be jumping at this trend, And because every one of them, the first one to do it, once one of them does it, everyone will do it. But, when that happens, I do not know. And if it doesn't happen by July 17th, which is the anniversary date, I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, I don't think it's going to happen either, because I don't think they want the American people thinking back, of course, and realizing that they knew the terrorists were involved and were planning on crashing their planes into our buildings. But, of course, if that is true, then when Dick Cheney, the day after the September 11th attack, said, gee, we knew there was going to be an attack, but who would ever would have thought that something like this would happen? They would realize, of course, his words were not true. Well, we're just about out of time. What are your parting thoughts for our listeners today? And again, the book is First Strike. It's available to World Net Daily. It's available to Amazon.com. Should be available to your local bookstore. first strike, get it, read it, and, of course, help us to get the truth out.
Parting thoughts. Today's Memorial Day. I just want to thank, the military people who have made this country as great as it is and who are not the culprits in this story. I just want to get that across. They do their job under difficult circumstances, and they are sometimes ill-served by their commander-in-chief. And we, as the people, are the ones who put those commander-in-chiefs in power.
Remember that, and I believe people have an obligation to be involved. God bless you. Thanks so very much.
Hey, Stan, thanks for having me on. It's my pleasure, and good luck to your audience.
Bye-bye. All right, well, that was Jack Kushel. Hope you enjoyed it. We've had him on several times before, and fascinating story. And simply another one of those cover-ups. But a story we have to get out. We do have a couple of 4-tape sets on this. If you would like to, you can get a copy of this evening's program, or you could order one of the 4-tape sets. We'd be glad to throw that in for you.
A copy of this tape.
We do carry that video, Silence, which is, I think, so vitally important. It's one of the finest videos I've ever seen. I say that with all honesty. That's called Silence. And, of course, it's the story of the downing of TW-800. And then, of course, this is the time when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. If you believe in what we're trying to do, if you believe that behind everything going on today, there are spiritual forces that have helped to conceal the truth from the American people, and that we're moving into World War III, that the America we've known and loved is pretty about to be lost, unless the American people are willing to stand up, unless there's revival in this country, unless America turns back to God. If you'd like to be part of our team, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. Let me close with the American reply to the poem in Flanders Field. Rest ye in peace, ye Flanders dead, the fight that ye so bravely led, we've taken up, and we will keep true faith with you that fall asleep with each across the mark his bed in Flanders Field. Fear not that you have fought for naught the choice you threw to us we cut. 10,000 hands will hold it high, and freedom's light will never die. We've learned the lesson that you taught in Flanders Field. And I'd like to ask, have we really learned the lesson? Do we have more or less freedom today than we had in those days? If we don't get involved, if we aren't willing to take a stand and make the sacrifice today, then the sacrifices those boys made and the wars of the past will be for naught. We have an obligation to be involved. Until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. Thank you. Well, good evening, Dr. Stan, here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that is going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line retired Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton, and of course we're going to be talking about what's going on in the Middle East. Now, Colonel Stratton was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on the 6th of August, 1947. He grew up in California in Europe, and of course he completed his schooling in the Monterey area. He graduated from the Seaside High School. He joined the U.S. Army during the Vietnam era, and of course he worked with SOG, Special Operating Groups. He returned to Southeast Asia, served in Europe and various bases in the USA. He served in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia 1982 to 1984, where he designed and trained and fielded the equivalent of our Secret Service for members of the Saudi royal family, served as Chief of Plans and Operations for Headquarters Command in Southeast Turkey from 1985 to 86. So he has a great deal of knowledge of what's going on in the Middle East, and he's completed his 26-year military career, where he worked at Fort Ord and as the garrison commander at the Presidio of Monterey. And then, of course, since he's been retired, he's headed his own business. He took on a specialty draining construction company as general manager and CEO, grew the firm by 1,000% in 5 years, and left that position last spring. He lives over in Monterey with his wife. And the reason, of course, we've asked him to come on, some of our friends had heard him, a good talk before a group of Republican women. And somebody called and said, you've got to get this Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton on, the most fascinating speaker we've ever heard. And of course, when one of our friends calls with such a glowing recommendation, why I called Colonel Stratton, he was kind enough to come on. Thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
You're very welcome, Stan.
Why don't you sort of give us a rundown of what's going on in the Middle East? Because we hear all of these things, and we hear about what's happening in Iraq now. We're going to have to keep our troops there for several years more, and then we keep hearing about what's going on in Iran, and Iran is developing nuclear weapons, and we hear about, of course, what goes on in Saudi Arabia, where they certainly seem to have a very autocratic government. There are a lot of trouble over there, and increasingly we seem to see the radical Islamic movement making headway in Turkey and in Pakistan and of course in Egypt, and it certainly would, of course, make increased headway in many of these other countries if it weren't that there are dictatorships in power there. So why don't you give us your appraisal of what's going on in the Middle East and how it will impact our listeners tonight?
And what I'd like to do to start that is do a quick review of seven key countries in the Mideast. They're all predominantly Muslim. We'll take a bi-country look after I do the orientation of them, and we can discuss projections for the future and entertain any questions that you have or the audience might have. The countries are, first of all, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and as you mentioned, I was there for 2 years. They have about 26% of the world's oil reserves. They're cash poor at this time, though, because of the growing population. They, as we now know, are the home of Al-Qaeda, where the Al-Qaeda was born and from which it was projected into other countries and unfortunately into ours and from where it receives significant funding. It happens to also be the only country without suffrage of the seven all cover. Iran is the second country, home of Hezbollah, funder of terrorism, probably the premier funder of terrorism in our time. Iran is also facing severe pro-Western pressures from students and faculty at their universities, and that's been in the paper here as we've gone through the last couple of weeks. We expected more student unrest, actually, until the government really cracked down and threatened them to the point where they were not going to be able to protest at the level they'd want it to, but that time will come. I'll talk about Jordan a bit. You know, Jordan has been pro-Western. They were the first to recognize Israel in that region. They have a critical refugee situation at home with Palestinians. And then when we look at Syria, you know, Syria is the home of Hamas. Hamas is based out of Damascus. They provide orders into Lebanon and into occupied territories with the terrorist acts that the Hamas execute or carry out. And Hamas really has two leaders. You know, they have an external guidance, and that comes from Damascus, and they have internal guidance, which comes from within. You know, the formal name of Hamas, at least the English translation, is the Islamic Resistance Movement. Now, Syria is also facing significant international pressure to give up state support of terrorism, and we've put them on notice here in the last month. We'll take a look at Iraq, too. You know, we have a significant post-war stabilization effort ongoing there, and it's not going to be over for a long time. We are nation building. You know, some people say we are not empire building, but for sure we are in the undergoing the stresses of nation building in that state in the post-Saddam era. We'll take a look at Turkey also. You know, we're facing fundamentalist Islamic and Kurdish pressures in Turkey, pressures that they want to join the EU. We have France threatening to delay that. We have Italy and Spain promising to press for an early entrance of Turkey into the EU. They have severe inflation, and then, of course, they have a conflict within their government of which way they're going to go. And then Egypt is another key player in the Mideast. You know, the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, they have severe economic stress. And then, of course, they have the fundamentalist problem in South Egypt.
Okay, and so it's this seems like sort of a hotbed, very unstable. And, of course, beneath all of that is this increasing influence of this radical form of Islam, which is totally contrary to the Islam that has existed predominantly for the last several centuries. Isn't this really tied into the Wahhabism of Saudi Arabia?
Yes, and not just Saudi Arabia, but for sure, that was the... You know, some of the basis for the origin of the Al-Qaeda, and they embrace that philosophy, which is very conservative. And, you know, and part of that, I think, has occurred because of the failures of the great Islamic civilizations of the past. And you look back in history and you see significant advancement in their civilization. It expanded over time and was a key player, you know, up to Europe, right? into part of Austria even. And then you have the collapse, you know, in the post-Ottoman era, and you have a significant decline in a relatively short period of time. And so you now have people who feel like they're failures. They have tremendous unemployment. They have a great disparity of the haves and the have-nots within all of the countries in the region. The literacy rate, you know, ranges anywhere from a bit over 51% exactly in Egypt, up to around 78% in Saudi Arabia, 87% in Jordan. So you have problems boiling in that area. And it's a cauldron that's just being stirred up. And you talk about the fundamentalism, the Islamic fundamentalism, the very radical version of that. And, you know, I would tell you that I firmly believe that that is where we will fight the Third World War.
Well, I think
fundamentalists on the Islamic side and everybody else.
Well, of course,
which I call civilization.
But I already think my impression is we're already in the Third World War. Certainly the head of the Israeli Mossad has said that. James Woolsey has talked about it. He calls it the Fourth World War. But, I mean, with our war with Afghanistan and Iraq, there are troops permanently stationed for all intents and purposes in the Middle East. I think we are already in the Third World War. Would you disagree with that?
No. No, I think we're in the opening battles. You know, Afghanistan was the first. The Iraqi campaign that has just finished its active phase, and now we're in the nation-building phase, is the second, and there are still many casualties to come, unfortunately. You know, God bless our soldiers, and everyone should pray for them. But that's just the beginning. I mean, this fundamental movement has the same mission for the civilized world as Hamas has for Israel. You know, Hamas's mission statement is to eliminate the Jewish state and replace it with a Palestinian state. And the Al-Qaeda, the fundamentalists out there, want to eliminate the civilized world and make it a fundamental Islamic planet that we live on.
Well, you know, I think that this is, seems pretty incredible for the average a listener to say that what are they talking about? And yet, at one time, the Muslim world was the greatest force in the world. I mean, they conquered all of North Africa. They had conquered Constantinople. They had invaded Europe up to Vienna, and the Battle of 1683 was the turning point. But had the Christian forces failed at Vienna, why we'd all be speaking Arabic? I mean, they had invaded, taken Spain. They were well into southern France. It was not until 1492 when, of course, the Muslims were driven out of Spain. But when they were the predominant culture in that area, they had a very advanced culture. They had tremendous literacy. They had tremendous advances as far as arithmetic and physics and all of these things. You look at the magnificent architecture, certainly a paralleling of the great architecture of Europe. Wouldn't you agree?
I think if you have ever toured Egypt and have done the Nile tour or have looked at the pyramids south of Cairo, it's absolutely amazing. I think that their accomplishments, when they accomplished those beautiful monuments, is well above anything that occurred in Europe after that.
Well, you know, having seen the Mosque of Omar there, built about, I think, 692, somewhere there, the late 600s, there that stands on the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. That is one of the most magnificent architectural buildings I've ever seen or been inside.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you see that again and again, whether it's ruins or partially restored ruins, but the magnificence, the size, and when you think about the mechanics that had to occur to build those items in the period in which they were built. You know, when you floated obelisks down or up the Nile, and then were able to stand them up. When you moved boulders that were carved and still weighed in multiples of tons, and you moved them with manpower and with ropes and some wheels and axles to place them as they did in the Great Pyramids. It's mind-boggling. It's absolutely overwhelming that a society could be so advanced, so refined in the mathematical aspect of it, in the engineering, and that then all collapsed into a point today where I go back and tell you that in Egypt we only have 51% literacy rate.
And of course, that really antedated the great Muslim empires. But be that as it may, certainly there was a great deal of culture here. And now you go in, and of course it's just a poverty, or the majority of the people living in poverty. And then of course along come the radical Islamists, and they say, "Look, follow us. We'll return to Allah. We'll kill the infidels. We will rule the world again." And it sounds crazy. But, you know, when you're living in poverty or abject poverty, or you don't even necessarily have to be, they offer these people hope, and with their, of course, what I believe is a false religion, doesn't really matter. It's what they believe, and they're willing to fight and die for it. I mean, how many Americans are willing to fight and die to preserve America today? We ask our young men to go out and do it, but how many of the older people are willing to give up the comfort of everything they have to risk their lives to preserve liberty?
Well, I got to tell you that my parents served in World War II, my mom with the FBI, and my father in the European and Japanese theaters, and so they were, and my peers obviously were, and I think our young soldiers today, both men and women, have really done great credit, brought great credit upon themselves and our great nation. But you're right. I mean, we're a nation of haves, and we have a lot of diverse beliefs, and there are obviously more than a few people who are saying that no war is worth fighting for. And you counter that by what's happening in some of the nation states that I mentioned earlier and elsewhere in the world, Indonesia, for example, parts of Pakistan. You have a semi-literate group of people in many cases, and you have education that is preached by the imam, the religious leader, in the village, in the mosque, that is interpretation of the Quran, not, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And that just ferments that the conservative interpretation just ferments a feeling, a gut feeling within those folks that if they can't have it, they're going to tear down what other people have. And that's the problem. It's not, if we dumped all the money available in the civilized world into those nation states I mentioned today, or into the ones that are the biggest problem, and brought the standard of living up from, let's just take Syria, where it's $3,200, up to ours, or 3,700 in Egypt up to ours, or Iraq, where it was only $2,500 per capita to ours, that still would not solve the problem. The elimination of Western culture, religion, nation states is what's going to solve their problem from their perspective.
But
that's why I say, and I think you agree, that we may be in or about to start what will be a very, very lengthy world war, number 3 or 4.
Amen. Amen to that. And of course, the thing is that if you destroy the West, that's not going to make them any better off at all. They think it's going to, but it's really not. I mean, what we need to do is change their worldview, give them an entirely different perspective. And of course, it's their religion that gives them the fanaticism to honestly believe if they die, killing the infidels, then they're immediately going to go to paradise, and anything would be better than what they're in anyway. And that's why you see the suicide bombers in Israel, or you can see the potential for suicide bombers here in the United States.
And that's correct. But, education is a key part of it. And I think a byproduct or something that contributes to that is communications. And we look at part of the nations that I've mentioned earlier on, and, they have very few cell phones, very few Internet users. In fact, I would tell you last year in Iraq, there were only 12,500 people online. That's amazing in a country of, my goodness, we're talking...
about 40 million somewhere there?
Almost, yeah.
Okay.
24 million people
24.
By CIA count,
okay.
In 2002.
Well, they probably have a better count than I do. Anyway.
I tell you another problem we have in Iraq, the growth rate's about almost 3%, but 41% of the population of Iraq is between the ages of 0 and 14. And that goes for Syria, where it's 39.3, Saudi Arabia, where it's almost 42.5%. So you have a tremendous group of youth who have been probably in the villages lesser educated, more exposed to the imams, the men especially, in the mosques, and they get this brimstone and fire preaching of the imam about conservative Islamic values and a very conservative interpretation of the Quran. And then these are the people that are going to be the soldiers of tomorrow, and some of them are the soldiers of today.
Well,
the martyrs that you talked about, and the people willing to strap, five pounds of explosives and 3 pounds of nails on their body and walk into a crowd.
A friend of mine, Carol Matriciana, has put together a video. It's called The New Order, New Barbarians, and it's basically the video footage that's shown on Arab television to the people of the Arabian countries. And, of course, it's aimed at the children, aimed at convincing them that they should die in battle. And the pictures of the little children there marching, you're talking about 6, 8-year-old children marching with their weapons and, of course, being interviewed. Of course, it's in Arabic, but the captions underneath, I want to die, I want to kill the Jews, I want to kill the infidels. These are kids 6, 8, 10 years old, preparing now to die, and day after day, week after week, month after month, this is what they're seeing on Islamic television, being broadcast into their homes, into their minds. And of course, this is really what's frightening.
Stan, it's going to take a full generation to counter the brainwashing that generation has undergone and the way they feel now. So if we could solve the Palestinian situation tomorrow, if everyone laid down their arms and lived happily ever after, you still have millions and millions of people who have been exposed to that from the time they were 3, 4, or 5 on TV, or in the mosques when there wasn't any TV or radio. That's going to be tough to overcome. I told you earlier, only 12,500 Internet users in Iraq. I mean, you compare that to a very modern country, let's just say Turkey, 4 million people online. Cell phones, 17 million cell phone users in Turkey. I mean, we probably have that many in California. But that's a hope, though. I would tell you, as we get power to the rural areas, as people get cell phones and get online, for sure that would allow terrorist organizations to communicate and coordinate and attack in the short term. But in the mid and long term, that bodes well for a more modern form of government to evolve as the people are exposed to Western values. And one of the countries that probably has the most exposure to the West has been Iran under the Shah. And you see what pressures the students and the faculty are now putting on their government and the debate within their own government between the prime minister and the president about which way they go. Do they stay conservative in the old Ayatollah Khomeini vein of what they want Iran to be as a leader of that Islamic world, or do they become more moderate and become secular, perhaps?
Well, of course, certainly the majority of the women in Iran don't want this form of government because they're oppressed by it. Almost half the population of Iran, even perhaps more so than any of the other countries, is very, very young, 25 or less. So, I mean, they don't want these. So you've got the vast majority, I think, of the people there who do not want this radical form of government, and it's only been kept in power by hiring hooligans to come in from other countries and beat up the students there, and the students get out and demonstrate, either they're arrested or they're beaten up by these hired thugs that the government hires to put down the demonstrations.
Yes, that's true, but you know, don't think that they have to hire them from elsewhere. They bring in Iranians, and they take their own people and make them thugs, and they go beat the students.
Right.
They do bring in folks from other countries. They've been a hotbed of terrorist training. The Republican Guard of Iran has provided training, and that's the home of the Hezbollah. And you can go to a nice terrorist training camp and get your BA in terrorist operations or demolitions 101 or whatever you want in Iran. And they export their training to the Bekaa Valley, where they have significant training camps, and that continues. But yeah, they do suppress their own people that way. And I firmly believe that within the next couple of years, you will see significant change in Iran from within. Will there be some stimulus from outside? Absolutely. Do we have agents working? Do we have Radio Free America type broadcast? Do we have education to try to modernize those folks? We do. But I think there's so much pressure from within, remembering that they had a full generation or two under the Shah that had Western values. They wore, blue jeans and Levi's. I don't know that they had any McDonald's when the Shah fell in 1979, but I wouldn't bet against it. And then they had this total suppression, including the significant suppression of the women. Only since 79 now. That's not been that long.
No, I know.
We're talking 24 years.
Well, of course, an awful lot of people fled there. Certainly the Zoroastrians, a lot of people fled just literally for their lives. The Jews fled, the Zoroastrians, anybody that, was not a Muslim, because, of course, they would face tremendous persecution. Why don't you tell us about Saudi Arabia? You lived there for 2 years, and, of course, you worked, of course, for the Saudi government. What's your impression about the situation there and the fact that you really have almost like a feudal kingdom, don't you?
Well, again, it's the only country of the seven I mentioned that doesn't have suffrage. Absolutely, it's a monarchy. It's ruled officially by King Fahd. In fact, his health precludes him from leading the country, and Crown Prince Abdullah is leading the country, along with other members of his royal family. But I would tell you, in my time in Saudi Arabia, I found the Saudis to be very benevolent. They were wonderful, warm, giving people. They were very social. I think every one of them smoked, and probably two-thirds of them drove a Mercedes. They had a great amount of wealth at the time I was there. They paid people $100 a day to sell newspapers. They had, three jobs for every Saudi, so they had to import significant labor, and they brought in what I would call semi-slave labor from third-world countries, and they brought in leadership, project management from France, from England, from the United States. To build most of what's been built in Saudi Arabia of the recent things. When they had that money, they had a great program to educate the Saudis, and in fact their literacy rate is about 78%, 84 for males and 70 for women. Women shared great wealth, though in fact they were covered when they went out in public, and they didn't drive. They didn't usually go to the mosque with the men either. They still enjoy their social life, and in fact, when we went to a Saudi's house for dinner at the front door, it was pretty interesting. You'd be greeted by the door person, the doorman, and the men would go in one door and the women would go somewhere else. And all night, the men would socialize in a room and the women would socialize in a room, and at the end of the night, the couples would meet on their way out and go home again.
But isn't there tremendous oppression of women in the Saudi system? In other words, a woman is totally subservient to her husband. He can divorce her simply by pronouncing it. He can have four wives. And, of course, if you are in the outs with your husband, you're in real trouble as a woman. My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if a woman is sexually assaulted there, she has to have four men verifying she's been sexually assaulted. In other words, she really has no rights at all as an equal citizen under the law.
I think it's not as bad in Saudi by any means as Afghanistan, where you can slap or beat a woman, and it's not a crime in most cases. That's a pretty simplistic statement there. But in Saudi, for sure, women don't enjoy all the freedoms of men. They have tremendous wealth. 40% of the national wealth is accrued to women. They, in case of sex crimes, they're challenged, and they're almost guilty until proven innocent, as opposed to our society, although in some cases I think we drag our victims through the fire too, and that's truly unfortunate. But I would tell you, going back to the time I was there, very benevolent. If you told a Saudi that you liked the lamp on his end table, he would give it to you and feel insulted if you didn't take it. Okay. Now, let's talk about what's happened in recent times, though, as the money dried up. And not the money, really, but the cash flow, because the Saudis still have about a $36, $37 billion surplus. But the flow of that cash into the country has been a problem, and they don't have all that disposable income they used to have. And so now you don't have the freedoms and or the options that you had before if you were in Saudi, of leaving the country and going somewhere else to visit. You have, in the meantime, the Saudi government at the national level pursued a very aggressive modernization program, but they kind of gave the imams the village and the mosques. And so you had really two societies evolving. You had a modern cosmopolitan society inspired by Western architects and engineers and built by Sri Lankans and Pakistanis and Koreans and Sudanese. But then in the mosques and in the villages, you had, again, the brimstone and fire preaching of the imams that became the Al-Qaeda movement.
All right, fine. Well, of course, but what about the average person? Of course, we're talking about, the generosity of the members of the royal family. What about the average Saudi there who is not part of the royal family? What is their attitude? And, of course, that would be the vast majority, wouldn't it?
Well, most average Saudis, let's call a non-royal family an average Saudi, most Saudis only have one wife, not three or four. They can't have up to four at a given time. Crown Prince Abdullah, when I worked for him, he was on his seventh wife at that time, and having only a total of no more than four at one time. But the average Saudi is going to have one wife, not more than one. He's going to still be a pretty giving, gracious person, very humble. One thing that was pretty amazing to me in their national makeup, their psyche, was that, when we go and diverge for a moment from politics here, and let's just use swimming for an example, because a friend of mine was their national swimming coach. And he trained and worked his team, the Saudi team, to...
Go ahead.
And they, and let's just say it was, X number of seconds for the 100-yard butterfly. But once they did that one time, psychologically, they felt no need to maintain that level or do it again. And so he finally gave up in frustration and left the country. He said, I can get them to that point, but I can't instill in them in that society that they need to do that repeatedly to perform at that level. Way different than us. If you have someone who's running the 100-yard dash here and he's doing, 9.9s, he's working on 9.8 and he's going to be down to 9.7. That was a societal difference that I think is key from some of our Western values of competition. They are far more prone to accepting whatever is the way that it is. In fact, a member of the Saudi royal family shared with me that they truly enjoyed the modernization. They enjoyed the great Mercedes and other cars they were driving and the high-rises and the mansions. But he said, if it all collapsed tomorrow and oil was worth nothing, we would go back to the desert and fly our Falcons and enjoy our Capsas on a tray, a communal tray, on a rug in the middle of the desert.
Yeah, it was a typical Bedouin lifestyle from which the Saudi Arabia family
and that's right.
They came, if it's right. All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment or two. Here at Radio Liberty, our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton. And, of course, if you'd like to give us a call, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We'll be right back here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton, retired from the military after, was it 24 or 28 years of military service?
Well, let's split the middle, 26 years,
all right,
Stan.
26 years. All right, fine. Well, of course, he's lived in Saudi Arabia, and of course, he's worked in Turkey, and of course, he has an excellent grasp of what's going on over there. But what about Turkey now? Because, of course, we see recently, of course, the parliament has been taken over by the Islamic fundamentalists. The army is still, of course, trying to maintain their ties to Western culture and Western civilization, following along in the reform movement of Ataturk. But you seem to find, at least for the democratic representation, an increased move towards this radical form of Islam, which is so destructive to, you know, their advancement into modern society. What's going on in Turkey, and what should be done?
Well, yeah, you hit it on the nail. You know, there's been a movement towards radical fundamentalism, and it's occurred in the villages, and the further east you go from that western seaboard, which I would draw a line from Istanbul to Izmir, you'll see more of that. It's probably a bit overstated, though there is a debate in their parliament, and they are becoming more Islamic in their focus than before. But, you know, they do have separation of church and state. I would tell you that, you know, after the coup of 1980, the military is firmly committed to sustaining a secular state. And though you have seen battles between the military and the civilian politicians and the debate within their parliament, I absolutely do not believe that the military would allow the nation-state of Turkey to go back to the pre-1980 era. You know, they have significant problems now with inflation. They really need the trade alliance of becoming part of the EU, and we have some sanctions against them that are unfortunate and unfair, I believe. That preclude them trading with us. But I think you'll see Turkey continue on a modernization and a pro-Western trend.
All right, because you call them a democracy, but as with so many democracies, yes, you can vote, you can put some people in office, but there is a ruling clique that are going to determine what really happens. Would that be a fair statement? Certainly this is what would appear to be in Algeria, where the military, with our backing, controls the people. The Islamists won the election there some years ago. Maybe that was Algeria. The Islamics won the election, and we wouldn't let them have it. We financed the military. The same thing is true in Egypt, in my way of thinking, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, they supposedly have democracy, and they, of course, the president always gets 98% of the vote because they don't allow any opposition. Would that be a fair statement, a fair evaluation of what's going on? Or is this real democracy, or is this makes everybody feel warm, good, fuzzy democracy, but in reality you've got a ruling elite, and it doesn't matter what the people really want. We just want to give them the impression they go to the polls. They vote every 4 years or 2 years or whatever, but we're going to control what's going on.
Well, I think, you know, in Iraq that was definitely true. You saw Saddam Hussein getting 99% of the vote. But in Turkey that's not true. You know, they have an emerging democracy. For sure it is not perfect. I don't think ours is perfect either. But your vote does count there. They have multiple political parties. Those political parties battle each other. There are three major parties. They have, you know, a Kurdish minority in the Far East that has some representation, and they're going to have to deal with that, and they are vitally concerned about what happens in Iraq and if a Kurdish nation state evolves out of the northern part of Iraq. That would not be in their national interest, and you've seen them move soldiers into that area and actually infiltrate special forces, special operations troops to protect their national interests, which is, you know...
In other words, we're protecting Turkey over the interests of the Kurds.
Well, I think, yes. I think that's a fair statement.
But why can't we let the Kurds have their own country? Why can't we give them the freedom, the ability to have their own country?
I don't know that that won't happen in part of Iraq. I think the Turks don't want it to happen in part of Turkey.
Okay.
They also fear that if it does happen in Iraq, that the nationalism that evolves within the Kurds regionally might then promote demands on part of the landmass of southeastern Turkey, and that's not acceptable to the Turks.
But I mean, the Turks have been down there killing off the Kurds, and repeatedly they've gone in almost with a genocidal ferocity.
You know, the Turks and the Kurds have been fighting for generations now, and I don't expect that to cease. The Turks have major elements of one of their armies in that region for control, and the Kurds are well organized and armed also.
Well, but then there's really not going to be any democracy there as long as the people don't have the right to establish their own government. And of course, this is the problem we have, is that we seem to be imposing our view on how people should be living their lives and backing those who would deprive them of that right. I mean, the Kurds have always wanted a nation.
I don't disagree with that, but I think that, you know, Turkey is a nation state, and we've supported that nation state more or less. Unfortunately, with the politics between the Turks and the Greeks and the 710 agreement, we've not been able to be full players with the Turks. But I mean, they have a problem of the Kurds in their sovereign nation state, and they're willing to let the Kurds play as a party within the nation state, but not as a terrorist organization in that southeast section, which part of the PKK does.
Okay, fine. Of course, the terrorists, I mean, we would call them terrorists because they don't go along with the government. They would call themselves freedom fighters, wouldn't they?
They probably would.
Okay. Well, this is certainly a boiling cauldron up there. What about Egypt, where, the president there, always gets all the vote? I mean, they just don't allow any opposition. That was the home of the Islamic Brotherhood. That was the beginning of this whole movement, even before Wahhabism became a major force. This was this fundamental Islam, but it's always been thoroughly suppressed by the Egyptian government with our help, and we're funding the people who are suppressing any effort to have any different form of government there. Would that be a fair statement or not?
Well, I think we have definitely given our support to the Egyptian government, and I think that's because we really view stability in that region as key to worldwide stability. If you look at the strategic location of Egypt, you also look at Egypt as embracing Israel early and being one of the hopes to bring peace to that region. The fundamentalists in the south, which is predominantly where they are, they infiltrate into Cairo occasionally, and there are isolated terrorist acts. But those fundamentalists are very, very conservative, fundamentally Islamic, al-Qaeda-type folks. And they don't want any Western presence, just as al-Qaeda doesn't. Al-Qaeda wants, all the Americans and all the other foreign nationals out of Saudi, and by the way, off the rest of the planet, too, sooner or later. Thank you very much. I think the government of Egypt is a legitimate government. Mubarak has been an ally. He's gotten mixed signals from us because of our inconsistencies over, the last couple of decades with our politics in that region. But in general, I think that he has modernized his country as best he can. They have significant problems. They have 70 million people. They have a growth rate that, though not very high, only 1.7%, has outpaced their economic gains, and so that means more poverty. A third of their people are 14 years of age or less. So they have problems they're going to have help with economically in terms of developing trade. They have a trade deficit. I told you earlier, they have a $3,700 per capita income, which is low in that region. One-third of Saudi Arabia, not quite as low as Iraq was, but other than Iraq, Syria and Egypt are down there at the bottom of the scale.
We've traveled in Egypt a number of occasions, and they just look like they're just so angry. They're not happy people at all. At least this is my impression of what I saw in Egypt. What would your thought on that be?
Yeah, I've always seen the Egyptians, both the ones who worked in Saudi Arabia, and there were many, and the times I've been in Egypt, in Cairo and up the Aswan Dam and throughout the country from there to the north, as being a bit less happy than some of the other folks in Turkey, for example. Turkey's a frivolous, happy group of people, though they're almost a cashless society in the villages. But the Egyptians have always been a have-not nation. They haven't had the resources. They don't have the resources now. I mean, they are oil poor. They have a little bit of oil, but they rely on textiles and tourism. And boy, tourism is in the tank. It was in the tank within a recession before 9/11, and after 9/11, it got worse, and it hasn't improved significantly. So they're cash poor, and that's going to hurt them in terms of stability. And we've got to look and see how we can help that government maintain its stability and its presence, not by suppressing any of the fundamentalists in the south. I mean, they're doing that on their own when and where appropriate, although I think they let some of those villages in the very southern part of the nation go, just as the Saudis have ignored some of their small villages.
You know, the thing is that once, as you alluded to early in the program, Saudi Arabia, Egypt was the greatest nation in the world. I mean, the pharaoh was the dominant force. The architecture, the accomplishment, the certainly the art, the culture, dominant in the world. You know, but this, of course, was 4,000 years ago. And look where we are. Look where they are today. And all they have in Egypt, to me, the impression I have, they got a glorious past and a miserable present.
I agree with that.
And of course, I have no idea what really can be done. What they need, of course, is, as you say, an economy. They need production. You know, they need to be able to enter into the modern world of exchange, and they seem to be almost locked in the past. And, you know, driving through the streets there, you know, the sort of the disrepair of so many of the apartment buildings, and they're just apartment building after apartment building, and the tremendous press of people, you know, and just living all on the very edge of poverty, not like it is in Africa, but certainly not the prosperity at all you see in Europe or here in this country.
No, it's a third world country. You know, they're probably never going to be in a position to own a three-bedroom, two-bath home that we enjoy. At the same token, though, I think if they continue to be very moderate in their interpretation of Islam, and if they look to the West for trade, that could well be their salvation. Again, the fundamental Islamic movement is a war we're going to have to fight. Egypt's going to have a choice of being part of that fundamentalism if the South, the Southern attitude prevails. I don't think it will. But if they can gain some better amount of stability and peace within that nation, they can then promote trade. You know, we look at all the trade or all the production that has moved out of America to China, for example. And I think we're a bit short-sighted there, by the way. But if they had some of that from Europe, some of the production come to Egypt and other countries in the Middle East, that stability and that source of income would so significantly improve their level, their, you know, of living, their quality of life, that by itself would improve the stability within the region, or at least within Egypt.
Well, I think the greatest export is the people who want to move into Europe to try to have a better life rather than staying in their own country. So what are we going to possibly do? I mean, here we are. We've got our troops over there. Certainly, I don't see our troops coming home. We were told they're going to come home as soon as the war is over, and you know, the war is not going to be over. Now we're hearing 4 years they're going to be there, and I think they're going to be more or less permanently. I mean, I think we are committed to a long-range battle. The first two shots have been fired in the Third World War. What should be done at the present time? Where are we going?
Let's talk about Iraq for a moment. I think we finally made the right move, albeit a bit late in Iraq. You know, we got Bremer in, and that was a step in the right direction. And now that we have a council of leaders in Iraq, excluding the Ba'ath Party folks, and they need to be excluded, they need to be destroyed, totally cut out of the future of Iraq in the short run, though they may resurface as a minority party after there's been a full, not only transition, but an establishment of a nation state in the post-Saddam era. But that council has got to be allowed to function now, and it needs to be able to project its power into the villages and into the towns outside of Baghdad in terms of a police force for security, in terms of laws and a judicial system. And that alone, where we showed that we are turning that country back to the Iraqis, we are going to be there to provide security as necessary in the interim, but with an exit strategy. And that exit strategy, unfortunately, may well be 4 years. It may be six. It may be seven. It could be three. I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. It's going to be dependent on a couple of things. Number one, cutting that last bit of cancer out of the Ba'athists and the Saddam loyalists in that triangle from Baghdad to Tikrit up towards the Syrian border. And then, very frankly, we've got to either find a cold body or a hot body or cold body parts, if you will, of Saddam Hussein to put them to bed. Because there is still a suspicion, a notion of fear across that country that he's going to be there after we leave.
And I think that's a very legitimate fear. That
I think so, too.
And, of course, if you'd lived under Saddam Hussein, you'd be afraid to speak out. In fact, these men who are assuming positions of leadership are risking their very lives, aren't they?
They are. Absolutely, and because, you know, with the fear, the prevailing fear that that he may return, and with him the Baathists, and boom, they're back in power, the government is where it was, and everyone who has been visible in the interim, you know, era, immediately goes directly to prison, doesn't pass go, or maybe gets their head or their hands chopped off. So we've got to get him. That's, and people are working to do that. You know, I believe he's probably alive. I believe they probably have good radio intercepts of where he has been, and they're tracking him down, and we won't rest until that's done. But
well, we can't,
the country's not going to rest until that's done either.
But we can't even find Osama bin Laden. We can't find Omar,
Muhammad Omar.
Omar over there in Afghanistan. So if we can't find Osama bin Laden with a big family, I don't know how many wives and how many kids he's got, we can't, are we really ever going to find Saddam Hussein? We can't even find the weapons of mass destruction that they told the American people that that they had. And of course, I think that my information we have from, I think, very reliable sources, they were moved into Syria. But of course, they don't want to tell the people that, but they'd move them out of there before we attack. Had you heard that?
You know, I had heard rumors to that. I'd also heard rumors that some were sold to Iran for their nuclear program. I would tell you that even if most of the weapons were deployed elsewhere, there will be remnants of that program that will become evident over time. How much time? I don't know. But we'll find remnants of that. And back to your question about, you know, finding Osama or finding Saddam, I think it'll be much easier ultimately to find Saddam because the box is smaller. If you look at the mountains of southeastern Afghanistan and into Pakistan, I mean, you could lose an army in there very easily. And you could also physically lose an army and fights in that area if you weren't careful. So we'll continue to pressure that area. We'll listen through cell phone intercepts and see if we can't track him down. For sure, we've been able to destroy the leadership of that organization. So the near-term attacks that we're now thwarting and the ones that we may see, if any, come to fruition are going to be some compartmentalized units acting semi-independently until they try to forge a new central organization. And we would like to think that we can, you know, probably get them as fast as they start to do that,
but of course,
with our listening capabilities.
But of course, the tragedy is that there still is totally instability over in Afghanistan. You seem to have, you know, a little stability in Kabul, and the rest of it is all controlled by warlords. There's no central authority, and of course, even the Taliban is beginning to reform. And of course, now you have clashes between Pakistan and Afghanistan. You know, we say the war is over there, but it's not over for the people who live there.
No, I mean, and it's not been over for a long time. I mean, that country has been in a state of war for generations now. And if you look at the geography of the country and you look at the warlords, it's much like Europe was in the feudal period. I mean, you don't have a great ability to project a central government and full central control over that nation state, given the geography and given the various factions. So you're going to have warlords, and I think you're going to have an alliance of groups of warlords that are going to provide whatever stability we have in Afghanistan for some time to come.
Well, are you optimistic or godly optimistic with this new council they have in Iraq that they're going to be able to get the electricity going, they're going to be able to restore water? Apparently you have electricity a couple of hours a day. You had electricity all the time under Saddam Hussein. Maybe you didn't have any freedom, but you had at least electricity and water and health care and a police force. You didn't have to be worried about, you know, being robbed at any time of day or night. We destroyed the police force. And of course, you know, we had people, a member of the Baathist Party, who were willing to set up, reinstitute the police, and we wouldn't allow them to do that. And now we have chaos. And you know, I find it so difficult to believe that with all the smart people we have in America, we couldn't have foreseen what's happened.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, they didn't have power and water everywhere. In Baghdad, they had power most of the time, and they had good water supplies. But that was at the expense of cutting off, you know, over half the population of Shiites in the south, and not giving them any power or any water. So the situation wasn't great under Saddam by any means, especially if you weren't a Baathist loyalist, Baath Party loyalist. But I think you'll see now, and you probably read it in the paper, they're recruiting ex-police officers to come back. We'll reestablish a police force. When I say we, I mean the council, with American assistance and support. We're going about it the right way. We're just, you know, we started about a month and a half late. We could have been on the ground a bit earlier with this focus, and if that council had been established, you know, the 1st of May, it'd be a heck of a lot better than it being established, you know, in this past week. But that council will take a little time, and I do firmly believe, I'm not guardedly optimistic, I think I am optimistic, that they will survive and they will thrive. Will there be hiccups? Absolutely. It's a third world country. There are dissident factions that haven't liked each other for a long time. Remember that the Baathists had all the power, all the wealth, controlled everything. No one had any freedom. You know, there were very few cell phones, only 12,000 internet users. You didn't have freedom of movement if you weren't one of the elite Baathists from, you know, Tikrit or from, you know, one of the west side of Baghdad, as Saddam called home.
Well, I hope and pray that there can be a stability and that these unfortunate people can have an opportunity for a better way of life. Now, of course, what do you foresee? We keep talking about democracy. Oh, we're going to have democracy there. But if you have a democracy, you've got a majority of Shiites, and you'll have the Shiites, of course, in control over everybody else. So we can't really have a democracy. We're going to have almost a Republican form of government where it would be represented from the various groups, but not on majority rule. Majority rule would be chaos in Iraq.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a representative democracy,
okay.
A Republican form of government. You know, we have the Shiites are about 60 to 65% of the country. The Sunnis are around 32 to 37. We have a few Christians, a few Jews. But I think you'll have a representative form of government that will reflect all of those groups, including the Kurds. And they'll have a say in that government. They do now. You have Kurds on that council.
And I think the thing is that you have to have a central government that can maintain order, but it's got to limit their power over the individual areas and let the Sunnis determine what they want to do, and the Shias determine what they want to do, and the Christians determine what they want to do, and the Kurds determine what they want to do, and limit the power of the central government over the lives of the individual people. Would that be a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, Stan, I think we should probably do a little bit more of that in America, too.
Well, I agree with you totally.
But, you know, you're right on there. I mean, we talk about a central government. It can't be a central dictatorship, because if you have that dictatorship, one party comes to the top as the cream, and they suppress everyone else. And so the government that evolves there, and the government that is in Afghanistan and will continue to evolve, is going to have to be one that grants significant autonomy to subordinate regions and leaders. And so you have the warlord that maybe controls, you know, 20,000 square kilometers in the southwest section of Afghanistan. You're going to have to be able to address the needs of the Shiites, the Sunnis, the Kurdish folks in the north, and be able to do that with some amount of fairness to create stability. Remember, though, that you have only a small percent of the folks were the haves in that country, so there were a whole lot of have-nots, and as they see power and water and the ability and freedom to move and money where they can go to the market and buy things they couldn't ever buy when they were buying meat once a month, you know, for the last 15 years, that will enhance the stability of that region.
All right, now what about Saudi Arabia, though? That is the big question mark. What's going to happen to Saudi Arabia? That is certainly got this tremendous storehouse of oil for the world.
Well, yeah, the greatest known reserves in the world, 26% of the world's oil and a significant amount of the natural gas, though not quite as much as Iran has. I'll tell you what's got to happen in Saudi Arabia. First of all, we have to get to a point where they have free elections. It has to be initiated. I think it'll probably start in the villages and perhaps with a council of advisors to the royal family at national level. But then after it's initiated, it has to expand into the cities. Additionally, defense spending has got to be curtailed. The Saudis spend about 13% of their wealth, their gross domestic product. It has to go down to about half of that. You know, they're way over everyone else in the region at the expense of giving the people what they need. The population and the increasing number of young people have got to be educated. Cell phones and internet access is going to help, I think, very frankly. And we've got to be able to get them to a point where they can talk to folks who have other values and see what is happening in other areas of the world. Especially, you know, it could be critical for the women in Saudi Arabia, the young girls. Those things will help stabilize that country, and the royal family is going to have to give up some of their power to do that, and they're going to have to be the folks that initiate it, because they've got the power, and that's, you know, you need the power to do that, to initiate that, unless you have a revolution.
Do you think
and we don't want a revolution.
Well, do you think they have the insight and the wisdom to relinquish power peacefully?
You know, I would hope so. I haven't spoken with them, so I don't have any insider knowledge there. But I would tell you that they are almost all Western educated. They have traveled around the world. They've talked to all the Western leaders. Their military leaders have gone to our schools and British military schools, and their populace has gone to UCLA and Berkeley and UVA, University of Virginia. So I think the odds might be better than we would think.
What about, are they going to stop funding Al-Qaeda? Because they funded them before 9/11, they funded them after 9/11, 15 of the 19 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia, there's Osama bin Laden. Certainly they have been the major, one of the major, that with Iran, as you mentioned, sources of funding for the Islamic terrorists. What are we going to do about that? The president has said, if you're funding the terrorists, why, we're not going to put up with it.
Yep, you're right there. I would tell you that the Saudis for a long time had this notion that they could buy folks off, and so if someone was a perceived threat to them, whether it was Hamas, Hezbollah, another nation state, by throwing dollars at them, they could make sure there was no internal threat, no domestic threat. Much to their surprise and then shock, Al-Qaeda did come into being, and then Al-Qaeda has now blown up things in Saudi Arabia. Not only do they have to stop providing funds for them by some wealthy Saudi families, and at the national level, they're not funding Al-Qaeda, by the way, but they have to go out and attack and kill Al-Qaeda. They have to grab that snake and cut its head off.
But do they have the will to do that? Because if they did, they'd have the clerics after their head.
Well, that's going to be a battle. And remember what I said back in the 80s, the royal family kind of ceded the mosques and the villages to the imams, who then preached that brimstone, hot Islamic fundamentalism in some cases, not every case. They're going to have to undo that. They're going to have to take and export democracy, export, councils in towns and cities and regions, and then a national council, and facilitate national elections, and then renegotiate the royal family's position in all of that to maintain Saudi Arabia as we know it today. And that's probably not quite the right word. It's going to change significantly, but it's not going to be a revolution. If they don't, and if Al-Qaeda gains preeminence without any big amount of funding, then you'll see the potential in Saudi Arabia for a revolution, and that would truly be unfortunate. It would not be in anyone's national interest except the Islamic fundamentalists, who see a pan-Islamic world at the expense of everyone who's not on their side of the fence.
Well, our guest has been Lieutenant Colonel retired Jerry Stratton. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real pleasure. I hope we can get you onto some of our other programs. You have a great deal of insight, and I think a great deal of knowledge. I'd like all of our very audiences to hear it.
Sam, thank you very much. God bless you, and God bless America.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Good night.
Good night.
Okay, fine. Well, I hope you enjoyed our interview tonight with Lieutenant Colonel Stratton. I think that the people who recommended him were right on. I think he's got a tremendous insight and understanding of what's going on over there. And so we will try to get him to our other stations as well. I hope you've enjoyed the program. Hope you begin to see that the quagmire we're in World War III. The average American doesn't understand that. But, of course, America is going to be changed tragically forever. And, of course, your job is to understand what's going on and understand, in my way of thinking, the spiritual forces which are motivating this whole thing. And, of course, their ultimate goal, a new world order, a new world religion. Well, pray for America. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. Pray for revival. But please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And so until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you. you stand here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that is going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line retired Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Stratton. And, of course, we're going to be talking about what's going on in the Middle East. Now, Colonel Stratton was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin on the 6th of August, 1947. He grew up in California in Europe. And, of course, he completed his schooling in the Monterey area. He graduated from the Seaside High School. He joined the U.S. Army during the Vietnam era, and of course he worked with SOG, Special Operating Groups. He returned to Southeast Asia, served in Europe and various bases in the USA. He served in Riyadh and Saudi Arabia 1982 to 1984, where he designed and trained and fielded the equivalent of our Secret Service for members of the Saudi royal family, served as Chief of Plans and Operations for Headquarters Command in Southeast Turkey from 1985 to 86, so he has a great deal of knowledge of what's going on in the Middle East, and he's completed his 26-year military career, where he worked at Fort Ord and as the garrison.